Next session, our panelists are asked to cast their thoughts to 2034, so 10 years from now, and share their perspectives on opportunities for the circular economy. What are we doing now? How will this change in 10 years? And what are the opportunities to capture? What is needed to get there? And one thing that we should get started on. Our experts will use both their sector and their broad lens views to share what we can start doing this afternoon. So please welcome to this session Professor Reniga, who has been involved in circular economy for as long as I know. So she's going to be the moderator and do a keynote. I'd also like our expert panelists, Tanya, Johannes and Helen, to please come and take your seats here. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. Bob, it's bright up here. Hopefully it'll warm up the room a little bit more, these bright lights, for those of us who are freezing. When Nicole asked me to moderate this panel, she also asked me to say a few words about the COP. I've just come back from the COP. You might ask me, what was I doing at the COP? Well, I was launching my book on circular practices in buildings and construction to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. You can download it for free. The soft copy is free. So I'll encourage you to have a look at it. And it really talks about the work I've been doing since 2015 with the UN. And Joe, you mentioned the Global Alliance for Buildings and Construction. So we started this work as co-leading the Sustainable Buildings and Construction Program for the One Planet Network. And now that's become part of the Circular Built Environment Program for the Global Alliance for Buildings and Construction. But really what I want to do today with our esteemed panel members is do a little bit of backcasting and a little bit of forecasting, asking them to start off firstly by telling us a little bit about what your circular economy angles are, where are you coming from, what is your burning platform, and how do you look at circularity in your day-to-day, and I'll transition from here to here. So maybe I'll get you to start, Tanya, if that's okay with you.
Does this
work? Perfect.
Kia ora, ko Tanya hau taka ingoa. I am based in Aotearoa, New Zealand. My background in circular economy comes from an engineering discipline. So I'm a civil engineer by trade and discovered the circular economy probably 10 years ago when I loved all the theory but wanted to know what I actually needed to do as an engineer. And from there, where I work, actually looked at creating a circular design framework because I loved the idea around circularity but recognised it was a very Western view of the circular economy. And being in Aotearoa, it was looking at how do you bring that indigenous perspective into what we do and how we do things in that community aspect around resilience as well. So looking and bringing that to the built environment along with that digital innovation, how do we go faster? How do we do things more differently? So that's, my background where I come from. But the burning platform, I think, at the moment for Aotearoa is actually looking at what's been happening in Parliament around the petitions that's going in around the treaty. And I find it really interesting how the Te Māori views and the circular economy principles align really, really nicely. So seeing what they're doing and what they're challenging around that, the treaty that they want to rewrite, I'm fully behind what they're for, which is around whakapapa, which is around that interconnectedness. So where you're from, how you fit into whether that's your community, your environment, the kaitiakitanga, which is around guardianship. So how are we actually looking to guard our environment, not for just us, but for our whakapapa, we're looking at our children and our grandchildren. So when we look at that mokapuna decision-making, what does that do? How do we do that? So that, for me, is that burning piece of that's how I think we'll get there, is that movement from that indigenous perspective while the politics and everything else work their way through their processes.
Go ahead, Helen.
Wow. Okay. Well, my... Oh. Good afternoon, everyone. My original training was in economics, although I would never claim to be an economist. But interesting, when I think back to 18-year-old me, the reason why I studied economics was because I was quite passionate about the environment and wanting to contribute in some way. And I figured that economics was essential. I was living in Canberra, so the heart of government, the national government. And I thought, well, with economic training, I can actually do something useful. Sustainability wasn't really being talked about. Certainly, there were no degrees in sustainable development or let alone circular economy. So I studied human ecology, human biology, human geography, anything I could cobble together and squeeze into an economics degree. So it's quite interesting now that I've come full circle, excuse the pun. When I read Donut Economics a couple of years ago over Christmas, it was like there were fireworks going on in my head. I thought, okay, here's the economic framework that I should have had back then and throughout my working life, but I didn't have. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I've been working in product stewardship, eco-design, life cycle thinking, mostly product-related environmental consulting and research and policy. I'm currently working with ThinkStep ANZ, which is a cross-Tasman sustainability organisation, working with clients on sustainability strategy, circularity, and so on, which is great, very interesting. We work with some very passionate clients that, you know, help me get out of bed every morning and go to work. My other passionate project that I'm passionate about is Circular Plastics Illawarra, which is a community organisation based down in the Illawarra, New South Wales, where we're working with councils and community groups and passionate citizens to try to build more circularity into the plastics economy, focusing on soft plastics at the moment, but hoping to do more. And if I had a burning platform, thinking forward, I know we're going to go into this a bit more, but we need to address the elephant in the room, which is consumption and demand, and how can these strategies that we've all been talking about help to not just recover materials at end of life, but try to narrow the flow of materials into the system in the first place.
Thank you, Helen. Yunus.
Yeah, thanks, Helen. Can I build on that? I've been in sustainability consulting for probably 20 years, which means I had the pleasure of visiting probably hundreds of different manufacturers around the country and look how they produce the materials. We use everything from steel, cement, wine, and textiles. And one thing that I noticed that all of these have in common is that they're very efficient and very mindful about how they produce the things we consume. And that's not really the problem. The problem is what they use. The materials are not circular. The ingredients that they use are not circular. And it's not easy for them to select circular feedstock. And what happens downstream is typically that you favor the cheap, the less durable, make and waste kind of products. So from a manufacturer perspective, knowing that they do pretty much everything they can, we need to change the system, so to speak, and make it easier. And that's kind of what drove me into circularity and circular economy, because it offers the framework for that kind of systemic and holistic approach, which we need, because all the individual players in the market are rational and doing, you know, the right thing from their perspective, but there's too little of pulling it together and stitching it into kind of overall rational and sensible solutions. So that's my pet peeve.
Well, thank you, Tanya, Helen, and Yunus. Now we'll fast forward to 2034. So imagine we are now in a stage where we're not using virgin materials. We've got the ISO standards on circularity that was launched in July this year. So everybody's using the standards. There's a level playing field. We have, I don't know about our consumption and production practices, but we'll leave that aside for now. But when you look back to today, 27th November 2024, what would you say are the drivers that's helped us get to that point 10 years on? Who wants to go first? Helen, would you like to start?
Sure. Multiple drivers, of course. Given my background in product stewardship, I would say we need a strong regulatory framework. I love the fact that so many companies are doing the right thing voluntarily, and probably a lot of them are in this room. But we do need a comprehensive policy framework to drive a lot of this, to make sure we don't have free riders. to make sure that brands are taking responsibility for their products, both at the design stage, through the life, and then at end of life. We've got ad hoc policies at the moment. Sure, we've got computers and we've got TVs and we've got packaging and so on, which is great, but it needs to be universal. It needs to be regulated. We need to build the sort of financial incentives into the system to make this change happen fast. I think one of the things that's really lacking at the moment is a sense of urgency. And I agree, everyone's behaving rationally. Companies are behaving rationally. If they're not driven strongly by the market or by regulations, then they're only going to do so much based on the goodwill of the staff or the owners. But I think we do need to accelerate. And I think if I'm looking back this wonderful situation in 10 years' time, I would say that the circular economy framework was published at the end of 2024. It was ambitious. It included targets. It included reporting frameworks, accountabilities for everybody. And I know Paul Klemenko was saying earlier that they're haggling over the last words of the framework. We'd like to see that as a coordinated national approach that brings everybody on board with a sense of urgency and shared vision that's then supported by multiple regulations, including extended producer responsibility, product stewardship, just as a starting point.
Thanks, Helen. That's great. I hope Paul was listening to this. Jonas, would you like to go next?
Yeah, I agree with what Helen is saying, but also looking back and looking at a topic. I work a lot in life cycle assessment and embodied carbon assessments, and specifically in the building and built environment. And if we look back 10, 15 years, that's when the industry started to work with uniform kind of measurements of impact of building materials. But 10 years ago, we started the Environmental Product Declaration Program in Australia and New Zealand to kind of standardize the declarations of environmental impact for construction materials. Everyone's really excited and really pleased with the growth, because there's been more and more companies every year that's come on board. And right now it's very much about embodied carbon. But if we do a reality check of where we're at, over those 10 years, we have 100 companies that have gotten on board and produced environmental product declarations. There's 300 EPDs or environmental product declarations in the market in 2024. And if we continue at this pace by 2034, I don't even want to think about how insufficient that's going to be. So I suppose looking back where we need to be at 2034 is where we democratized transparency and data so that every manufacturer can participate and in a cost-effective way produce and declare their information, relevant information. And it's going to obviously need to be digitized and kind of connected to all the other systems and processes and tools and databases we have. And to your point, Joe, I don't know what that digital piece needs to be kind of relevant 50, 100 years from now. But I know we need to kind of get to that sharing and democratizing and scaling up, because at the pace we're going now, and just on embodied carbon, it's so insufficient. And we haven't even started on circularity metrics and data. So lots to be done. So we need to simplify it and make it more widespread for sure.
Thank you, Eunice. Tanya.
I love those ideas. And I would take those and build on them. What we saw last year in Europe at the industry tour was around how procurement was fast-tracking change while we waited for regulations and the frameworks to catch up. So I would love to think that we're taking that on board and changing how we procure and really pushing the boundaries on how we procure. So the Netherlands use a carbon shadow price of 880 euros for any of their projects. So as a civil engineer doing a design, you would actually have to use that value. And that was really showcasing the impact that you were having. And so I think looking at things like that and getting that consistency, and they had a minimum requirement of what you did and how you did things. But with that procurement, I would like to see the planetary boundaries included in that assessment. So it's not just a carbon tunnel that everybody seems to be looking at. We're working at the moment where we can design a road and have a couple of options, and we can now assess the planetary boundaries and we can see what the difference is on those two options. So you can actually have a discussion at the table around something else than the cheapest price run to the bottom, which we're currently at, which is very frustrating. And so getting that different conversation at the table around what is important to us, because what we heard is metrics matter, and what is really value to you is what you focus on. If we're focusing on our GDP and our cost, then that is exactly what you're going to get. So unless you change that, you've got no hope. So I would like to see that changed too. So digital acceleration, getting that procurement sorted, and then the other one for Arturo is around that ancestral intelligence. They call it AI. Love the phrase, but it's around stop using our culture to make things look pretty. You have all these lovely patterns that you're just sticking on the side of, whether it's buildings or infrastructure. That is not what it's around. It's around the intelligence we've had for hundreds of years. Use it. So that, I wish I could claim it, but I listened to a guy present 18 months ago, and it gave me goosebumps around. We had a cyclone come through in Auckland, and he said, I used AI to work out how to go and collect my daughter. She was staying at a friend's house. And so when he started explaining it, he talked about the family history, that the knowledge that got passed down of knowing where to go and how to navigate his way across the city to be able to get to his daughter, because they have a lot of that knowledge. So I would love that to be integrated into just what we do as BAU.
That's great. I just want to remind the audience about questions. We've already got two questions that have come through the chat, but feel free and remind yourselves to add more questions should you wish to. But perhaps I might go back to you, Tanya, and get you to talk a little bit more about what New Zealand has done so well, and something that we really need to learn from the Australian context around co-design, co-producing, co-creating with First Nations peoples of New Zealand. What can we learn from that?
Interesting that we get put up on that pedestal, because I still think we have so far to go. Most of our processes rush because we want an answer and we want to get through to the end. So I think being able to, if you're actually going to genuinely co-design, it's actually taking time, building relationships, and going at a pace that brings everybody on that journey. I know myself, coming from the UK a long, long time ago, I was just in a rush and not taking that time to understand and work out what it really means. We have been working on our circular design framework. We actually gifted to Engineering New Zealand because it brought that Indigenous view into how we can approach our designs. So it's asking different questions of our design groups and asking, how are you genuinely engaging rather than just a transactional aspects to what you're designing? So having somebody who's integrated into your project team, thinking about the communities, what they want, and how do you interact? There's some awesome stuff that's happening around like nature-based solutions. So how do you use native materials around the assets that you're building, but then how do you actually get an economy with the local community that's using those products that are grown to actually give back more than what you take? So that would be.
Yeah, certainly a lot for us to think about here in Australia. Jonas, I might ask you this question. You talked about the importance of data and transparency, but I suppose a more fundamental question, and again, thinking about 10 years from now, is do we have transparency when we talk about the language that's associated with data? So when we talk about circularity, do we all know what we're talking about? And then when you start talking about net zero talking about even carbon, are we using the same taxonomy when we talk about this? What's your thinking?
Well, no, we don't, right? So there's too many metrics and too much, from my perspective, too much nuance in everything we do. Even when we talk about carbon, there's so many different concepts within carbon: embodied carbon, life cycle carbon, biogenic carbon, fossil carbon. It's just endless, the amount of ways you can break it down. And I feel like it's actually confusing more than helping. And when we come to circularity, my experience is that there's a lot of discussion and debate about what the right metrics are, whether it's Ellen MacArthur Foundation or material flow analysis or whatever it is. There's a lot of different alternative ways to do it. So I don't feel like there's any agreement on it at all. And even if you pick a simple topic like recycled content that Lucy was talking about, that I want to drive through the BDA development, even that comes with a lot of nuance and definitions in terms of what type of recycled content we're talking about. So no, it's very difficult and challenging area, even for us that work in this space. And coming back to the point as well, that we actually do need to simplify it and come to agreement, even if it's not perfect, in order for us to move forward. Because the measurement and metrics is fine. The detail is important. We need to measure in order to improve. But at the end of the day, it's that improvement that's needed. Doesn't have to be the decimal point right. It's, are we moving in the right direction, in the right areas? And that's where we ideally, looking forward, have much more focus on and much more encouragement, rather than I have the perfect measurement of X, which doesn't matter unless you are moving, right? So no, we don't have the right language, we don't have the right taxonomy, or we don't have an agreed one. But is that really the most important thing to focus on when it's about the change that we need to implement and drive? So maybe we need to be a little bit less perfectionistic about it.
Great point. Thanks, Jonas. Helen, I'm going to turn to you, if I may. You talked about the importance of the policy context, but what about the governance? Policy context? What about the governance? Can you throw a little bit of light, and particularly given all the problems that we've had across the local, the state, the national, EPA regulations are different across different states. Would you like to take us through a little bit on this governance context as well?
Well, we could talk all day about that, really. I mean, it's a mess in Australia, isn't it, really? The policy situation, we've got multiple jurisdictions with different and sometimes conflicting regulations and policies. We've got the feds trying to develop a sort of a coordinated framework and, you know, harmonised regulations. But it's very messy. And I guess that's one of the areas that we'd all like to see addressed, let alone shared language, shared understanding, shared metrics. Just as a bit of a aside, I agree absolutely on the need to simplify the language and not confuse people. Now that we're using this new language of circular economy and circularity, we need to make it clear to people that we're building on stuff that people are already doing. Those of us in the room sort of probably understand that circular economy is a bit different. You know, we're now bringing in that economic context, the idea of value and retaining value, recovering value, and so on. But I was just thinking about, I was with a company the other day and we walked into their room because they just wanted some advice, and they had a whiteboard that was covered in scribbles. They just didn't know where to start. There was GECA standards, there was ISO standards, there was the GBCA, there was this regulation, that regulation, and there were arrows connecting things that they thought, and then there was European standards and there was digital passports, more arrows, more connections. And they said, look, we're happy to spend money, we just don't know where to start. And I thought, this is the state we've got to, where this lovely company that was so well-meaning just did not know. They were just totally confused by the language. And they thought they had to rush and get an EPD. And we said, well, no, you don't really need to rush and get an EPD. You need to think through as a company what's important for you and where you need to go as a next step. I wasn't really talking about governance, but yeah. I just think we're at risk of using a lot of jargon and not communicating the fundamentals to really win people over and get them excited about the idea of circularity and how they can benefit and how, you know, what it means to them.
Do you want to come in, Tanya?
Only just to share, I'm assuming with you all being circular people that you know about Dr. Jacqueline Kerr's book on network governance, and especially around when you talk about, she calls it the messy middle. So we had about an hour with her where we picked her brain, and she's just an amazing lady. But she was talking about how we use the R ladder. We always go to recycling. I should have played bingo on how many times I heard recycling today. But she said, start at the top, don't start at the bottom, because if you start at the bottom, you'll be forever going around the bottom of the ladder. You have to start at the top. You need transition brokers to help with that messy middle, because there is so much going on to work out where your influence points are in that process. So if you can then work out what your system levers are, because that's that system acupuncture that you need. And part of her work was around, I think it was mattresses, concrete, looking at steel, how to change the system, how you need to bring everybody along, because you can't just change for one or two people, because you'll never get the system to change. So what are the levers for change, and how do you get the industry or the sector for change? So I was really excited to hear, like, today around the lab. So they have circular economy living labs around how do you actually change this really hard, gnarly, wicked problems. So the book is really good, and she provides some insights onto that side of things.
And I think just as a reminder, the other thing that Jacqueline always talks about is don't start with the barriers, but start with the opportunities, because you'll get stuck. When you start with barriers, they're a mile long and you don't know your way ahead. So focus on the glass being half full rather than being half empty. But I might turn to some questions that have come through. This one has got two likes. We've heard a lot about First Nations and Indigenous involvement in the transition to a circular economy. Are there any frameworks that include this perspective to help us to get to 2034? Maybe start with you, Tanya, if that's okay.
Yep. The only one I'm aware of at the moment is the one that we have developed, and we've developed it internally with our Te Atu Tata team. So they're our cultural navigators, which we gifted to Engineering New Zealand. So that's all as part of that organisation. So there's all the training on there. There's systems thinking. They brought in our six different experts, which looks at resilience, social aspects, so that behaviour change, the cultural, as well as the circular economy principles, just to integrate. I don't know of any others that have that cultural integration, but ours has a whole list of questions that you should be starting your conversations with to try and get a different outcome. There's a lady somewhere just over there that's always reminded me that the linear economy has had 200 years of questions, and now we need to start asking different ones. So Deb was the one that helped us create the different questions to go, how do we actually start on a different journey, a different footing?
Did you want to come in, Jonas or Helen, just to comment on this?
Maybe just it's encouraging to see it's being integrated more and more. For example, we did work with the Green Building Council's nature roadmap. And it was a natural part of that. We can't provide a roadmap without proper Indigenous kind of input and ownership and contribution. So it was great to see that that was a really core part of developing that roadmap. But in terms of frameworks available, I'm not really aware of much at all.
I think it's just a huge lost opportunity in Australia. I mean, I'm always amazed and impressed with the way New Zealanders do try to integrate the thinking in what they do, the language, the formal processes they go through. We're just not doing it in Australia at all in any meaningful way. And in terms of what we're thinking about, it's just an obvious pathway, isn't it?
Just to sort of come back to the question of frameworks, I know that Sustainability Victoria, and there are people from Sustainability Victoria in the audience, so maybe talk to them about their strategy where they've incorporated First Nations thinking. I know some people that were involved in that. I know some builders, at least in Victoria, have also engaged First Nations people, but not in a, you know, there's no ready-made framework off the shelf that people can use. It's still very much work in progress. And I think that there's two hands in the audience. I don't know if there's a microphone, but maybe you can shout out.
Not to say on the government part, but it's else, but connecting with country and designing.
Can I just give her a microphone? So Government Architect New South Wales has developed a connecting with country and designing with country framework, which is freely available and actually something that architects and designers, developers need to follow for state significant developments.
Great, thank you. Any other? Yep, Caitlin?
There's a one called a country-centered donut model. So it was actually introduced at the last Circularity Conference. So Paul Malott Damien Malott and Paul someone. So it incorporates circularity with the donut economics approach and brings in Indigenous Australian cultural principles.
Thank you. Great.
That's reminded me, actually. Project Moonshot actually took the donut and changed it with a Te Māori view. So they actually flipped it inside out. But again, that's readily available on their website. So that's Project Moonshot.
Great. Any shows of hands from the audience? No. Okay. Then we'll move to the other question. And I think this might be more directed to you, Jonas. What innovations in technology do you anticipate will drive the next leaps in circular economy practices by 2034? And how can we ensure these technologies are accessible across different economic sectors? Do you want to start?
That's a little question for
me. Goodness. I'll stay in my lane here. I think talking about the data that needs to flow through and the technology there. I think it's a lot of talk about digital passports. I've heard it through the day here. And I think that's where we're going to see a lot of innovation in terms of getting the right data in place that's shared and accessible in different tools. That's going to really help a lot with decision-making, screening, understanding what products are in play in the economy and what to do with them, what's the proper kind of end of life or reuse opportunities. I see that's a huge opportunity that we're just embarking on at the moment. It feels like every conversation is, well, we're building a new database, we're doing this, we're digitizing this, we're building tools. So there's so much innovation in this space. We work a lot on decarbonization, and it's a whole sector in its own right. There's probably 50 tech startups out there kind of trying to solve the carbon accounting smarts in different ways. So that part of innovation, I think, is that's going to go somewhere. All the big tech companies are involved in this and investing a lot of money. So I think that's huge. When it comes to the actual manufacturing and recycling and reprocessing, there's also obviously a huge need for that, considering the linearity of the economy. And all the challenges that were talked about before in the product stewardship forum here, that practically we need that logistical and kind of manufacturing processes as well. But I think, yeah, at least on the data and tech, that's going to go a far way from where it is today in a couple of years. So I'd feel pretty optimistic about that part, at least.
You want to come in, Tanya?
Yeah, I'd love to add. So we're partnering with Planet Price. And so they're the ones that have helped us with our built environment at work. So we've had a design of a road. We've done two different designs, about the same physical works cost. We've put it through the platform, and then it's given us our impact on the planet. One was double the impact of the other, so we could have that conversation. But what our digital team has done is taken the 3D space, sucked the data out, done the assessment, and then pushed it back in, and then it lights up like a Christmas tree, and then I can work out where I need to make the effort. If it's the carbon, I can focus on all the carbon heavy areas. If it's water, I can look at that. So that's been really cool doing that. But what we've also done in our partnership, we've taken a ministry in New Zealand, they've taken all their data, gone through with AI, tidied it all up, given them all their scope 3 as well as the planetary impacts. We partnered with them for a school event with Climate Week, and we've done it twice now that the schools keep asking us to go back with 13 to 15 year olds, where we've looked at the textile industry with a t-shirt, and this year we did a mobile phone. It's disturbing that kids don't actually know where that cotton is grown and it takes a lot of water, or that the metals in a phone, where they come from and the impact. But what was really interesting that we did the numbers on the planetary, that the impact, the cost to the planet for the mobile phone, and it was $96. So we said, for a $1,400 phone, would you be happy to pay the $96? And they're like, oh yeah, but that doesn't seem much. So I did a quick Google, and it said there's 8.5 billion contracts out at the moment for mobile phones. And probably, for show of hands, how many have got more than one phone, or there's a spare phone in the drawer, however many more. So you think, how many phones are out there times $96? So there was, 8.6 billion times 96. That's a lot of money and a lot of impact on the planet that we're not paying for. Who is paying for it? So it was a fascinating session with the kids, that they walked away going, I shouldn't buy things on Temu. I should keep my phone for more than a year. All these different things that were coming out to help that behavior change, because that's one of the things that I think it's really missing from the conversation is the help around behavior change. That's of our designers doing things right as well as our consumers. So we need to look at the whole holistic process. And that's been something that's helping us have that conversation.
Go ahead, Helen.
So I was just going to make a comment. One of the areas that in relation to technology, I've been working in the plastics space for a long time, longer than I'd care to admit in public. There's a lot of interesting technologies that have been developed to sort plastics, to identify plastics automatically and efficiently, to process them. It's been a huge amount of innovation. The barrier in terms of scaling it up, given that we recycle, you know, 13 or 14% of plastic waste at the moment, we don't have really a technological barrier. There's so much good work in universities and industry. There's probably a couple of barriers. One is the commercial realities, and that's where extended producer responsibility comes in to overcome that gap. We have another gap, which is around the social license. I don't know whether many of you have been monitoring, as I have, the proposed recycling facility up in Mossvale in the Southern Highlands. If it gets established, it'll be a 120,000-tonne capacity recycling. It'll be Australia's largest plastic recycler, which in terms of my group down in the Illawarra, I think is fantastic, but they don't have the support of the community. There's been a huge amount of outrage and opposition. It's now going through the planning process, and I wouldn't be surprised if it gets knocked back. It's in the wrong place, probably. I don't know enough about the details, but it's the first time I've been exposed to that social license in a really real way. It's a facility we need. It looks like it's a good facility. It looks like good technology. We certainly need it in New South Wales, but it's probably not going to get up. And I think that's one of the barriers as we start to expand. And one of the big issues for the community is microplastics. That we're aware that microplastics are released in the water from plastics recycling. This is a real problem in terms of managing trade-offs that we need to recycle plastics. If microplastics are an issue, we need that. That is a gap. That is where we need technologies to try to address that barrier.
And microplastics are in us as well.
Yeah, just when you described that, Helen, like one thing that came to mind is with a social license, but another angle to it. So, example, we worked with a major supermarket and looked at all the stuff that they sold in a regular supermarket and traced down all the ingredients and started mapping out the planetary impact of everything that sold. And we worked out that, yeah, that's about 3 million budgets, 3 million people's planetary budget. That's what they sell in the supermarket every year. It's a huge number. Most of it would be from the dairy and beef that they sell and the meat products. But then it comes to, what do you do with that information? How do you say, is this good or bad? You need to reduce it. How much do you need to reduce it? Are you going to be able to be competitive if you say, we're going to take meat off the supermarket shelves or limit it? Or how do you actually action that information to drive something meaningful that's not going to disadvantage you in the economy? Like this retail supermarket, they knew what the impact was down to the last kind of bit of ingredient. But the question is, what do you do with it? How do you drive it down, and how far and how quickly? We kind of have an idea when it comes to carbon, but when it comes to the planetary boundaries, what's the right way? Do we need to put a cost on it? Or, you know, how do we actually deal with that in the next 10 years? Like, that's the question.
So does anybody want to tackle that question?
The lady in the room that should be answering the question is the one over there. So feel free to go and have a chat with her afterwards. And she'll let me know if I've got it right or not. So we've had a discussion around, do you put a monetary value on it or do you not? At the moment with where we are, I think it helps the conversation because people can understand that bit. But I hope we do move away from it. We had a conversation earlier around labeling of things that you buy in the supermarket. And the story was around a bag of chips that had their carbon amount on it. But it doesn't mean anything to the people in the street. So if we want behavior change of the public and our communities, how do we communicate that in a way that they can understand? As professionals, we may understand the value of carbon as a number, not as a dollar amount. But I think that's our starting place. But hopefully, as we grow and mature, we'll be able to have a different conversation around what those boundaries are, those hopefully, I was going to say targets. I'm not quite sure I'm happy with the word targets. But we'll have what the quantity is rather than the dollar value. I think I answered that.
So if I might put it another way, if we changed our currency to a carbon budget, and if everyone had a carbon budget that was in line with the sufficiency goals of the planet, what would that be like?
So Dunedin, have actually, they did their donut for their city and were looking to do targets. Unfortunately, our governments have changed and things have changed. But I was really excited about where that was going. We started doing some work with Wellington City Council, who have also done their donut. And when you see the impact of their fresh water, it was shocking. And you go, it really gave you insight into where to focus. But having a budget for each, whether you do it per sector, it was a really interesting approach that we were really looking forward to trying to explore and understand. What does that mean if you do your infrastructure program, which we normally do for up to 30 years? How would you do that if you had to do that within the planetary boundaries? Because that's a really different challenge. And I really hope that we move away from our dollar constraint and do it as a planetary constraint instead.
Jonas, Helen, did you want to come in and take a punt?
Not so much about a carbon budget, but I guess one of the positive developments at the moment in the built environment, at least, is there's a strong focus on embodied carbon now. So organisations, whether that's product manufacturers or builders, developers, designers, are starting to focus not just on the operational carbon impacts, but the embodied carbon, which can be significant, obviously, if you're using cement and concrete, you know, those sort of products. So I think that's a positive step forward. The next step really is to say, well, what does that mean? Is that good, bad? Where should I be aiming for? Yeah.
Did you want to come in, Jonas? Any comments?
Well, just to show, like, there's been so much work on embodied carbon in the built environment, and it's all quite possible. And it's all quite possible and doing it cost-effectively or cost-neutral as well. So the question is, why is it not happening at the larger scale? What are the missing incentives, and what are the things that needs to come into place? And to the point from the previous panel as well, we all tend to focus on that intensity metric whilst kind of we're growing the overall volume. So it needs to kind of be working on both. We need to kind of have the sufficiency in terms of the volume, but to also work on the intensity. But I feel like a lot of the conventional materials and construction techniques are there available for us, but they're not being deployed at the moment.
So we sort of started off in 2034 and we've very much come back to 2024. So maybe we'll stick with 2024. What seeds of change, I mean, and we've talked a lot about behavior change and the importance of behavior change. So perhaps we'll use that as a lens. And I'd like to ask all of you, what do you see as being the important seeds of change we need to sow now for us to be able to reap that in 2034? Wants to go first?
I'm happy.
Yeah, sure, Tanya.
So I keep bringing it back to this indigenous view. What I really love about what I've learned with the Māori culture is that they don't look at 5 years, 10 years. They look at 100 and 500 years. So how do we get that long-term lens? So we're looking at our mokopuna. So what I would like to see is that the decisions that you're making are for those future generations, not for what's in your interests right now. So, and the challenge that I would actually set out to all of you is, where is your use at the table? I'm very conscious of being up here and going, where is the use? And all the panels and the discussions we've had going, where is that voice? I have my 8-year-old son who several years ago asked me what I was doing. Was I thinking outside the box? Because I needed to think differently to fix the problem. So how are you bringing that approach? Do you have somebody at the youth at the table in your discussions? How are you bringing their views? Because let's face it, they're the ones that are going to have to fix the mess that we're in now, because those are the generations that everything that is baked in, that the changes are coming. So that would be mine, is look longer view and get use in the discussion and help them with that ownership for how we need to change.
Helen? Where to start, really? I mean, just my mind was going wandering while you were talking there. I mean, the thing about the circular economy is where it builds on the sort of traditional ideas of circularity, it does bring value much more explicitly into the conversation and how we can retain and recover value, make more of the materials we've got. So how do we really turbocharge that? And I hate to bring it back to government because I know we can't always rely on government, but financial incentives, whether they're introduced by government or by businesses, are really important. So financial incentives for brands comes through the eco-modulated fees through product stewardship. Once again, I know that's come up quite a bit over today and probably yesterday. With consumers, how can we, obviously there's lots of ways to nudge consumer behavior, and Jenny Macklin can talk all day about that. But can we bring in some financial incentives into the relationship between brands and consumers? It could be regulated through container deposit schemes, have obviously been very successful. How else can brands connect with their customers and provide either monetary or non-monetary incentives to drive behavior change? I think we just need to think of all the levers that we can use. And I guess just thinking in terms of what we can all do in our businesses or our organizations, I think we need to bring that economic lens to that as well. Like, what are the risks? What are the economic risks to our business that are linked to circularity? You know, supply of raw materials. We're going to see a lot of change and a lot of pressure over the next, you know, 10, 20, 50 years, with some resources becoming either more scarce or much more expensive, or the prices are going to get more volatile. We've got a lot of resources concentrated in a few markets, you know, Russia, China, and so on. And we know what's going on in the world at the moment. So what are the risks to your organization? And, you know, that's one side that need to be addressed, obviously. But then what are the opportunities? Thinking of the positives, and obviously there are lots of opportunities in the circular economy, new business models, new products, new alliances. So I think it's not rocket science in terms of the starting point. You know, what are the risks? What are the opportunities for my business going forward?
I just want to bring us back a little bit to the opportunities that you mentioned, Helen, and particularly around innovation. And there was a comment made yesterday that we are very good at innovating in Australia, but we don't actually take that and the financial backup is not there. I'm just wondering, from that perspective, and again, thinking about the seeds of change that we need to have today, in the sort of work that each of you do, where do you see the need to put more perhaps money or regulation or even governance around innovation to help steer us to where we need to go in the future?
Well, having just been in the circular procurement workshop with Mayuri, thank you, it's really good, learning about procurement for innovation, I thought that was really interesting about how organisations can support innovation through their procurement process by sharing some of the risks, by, you know, guaranteeing procurement, assuming an innovation meets all of the functional and cost requirements. I think that was just something really interesting because we all know the power of procurement, public procurement, as well as the large organisations. So I thought that was interesting, yeah, as a way of driving it.
Any comment, Jonas or Tanya?
One of the things I heard last year when we were in Europe was we actually got left out and told that you Aussies and Kiwis don't actually know how to collaborate properly. You're too worried about IP. You're too worried about risk. And you're not actually addressing the elephant in the room and actually getting on with innovation and working out how to get over this problem together. So they have a long history around having to collaborate, especially because half their country is below sea level. So you had to work together to get that outcome. And we seem to have missed that. And we seem to fall into that economic trap around how do we keep making money rather than going, actually, we just need to work together. So I take my little one who used to love Frozen. And every time I get that little feeling, I tell myself to let it go. And I need to just work out how to collaborate. I would sing, but I've got a terrible voice. But you can imagine I'm there going, let it go, let it go. It will feel comfortable eventually, but I just need to let it go.
Okay, can I add to that? Because that's beautiful. And I think that's, you know, I've been warned about using the word collaboration here because that's been said enough, apparently. But I feel like we have proliferation of, you talked about the spaghetti code of certifications and ratings and everything that's just confusing. And in the next 10 years, what if we start consolidate and combine more and get rid of the noise in the market, make it simpler? Because we don't need 5 different rating tools doing a version of sustainability. We need to find a way to combine it. And if you have the instinct to launch a new database or a new certification, don't. Piggyback off someone else, join someone else's forces. I think that would go a long way to kind of declutter and focus efforts.
Okay, we didn't talk much about design, and design is such an important aspect of, particularly when you look at the hierarchy of the R strategies, and we've ended up, I think, in Australia, a narrative around recycling, whereas really what we need to do is nudge up the ladder, you know, move into the refuse and reuse and so on. From your perspectives, what do you think, again, you know, looking from 2024 to 2034, where do you see are the opportunities across these other R strategies moving away from recycling? Recycling, great. We need infrastructure for recycling. But how do we get our stakeholders to also buy into the idea of moving up the ladder of these R strategies? Who wants to start?
Well, I don't know. I suppose I've worked a lot with companies on design, particularly around packaging, not just packaging, but it is about simplifying it and engaging with cross-functional teams within organizations. It's really heartening and quite fun, actually, when you get the right people around the table and you put the challenge in front of them. I guess with packaging, it was mainly about recyclability and recycled content. We're now talking about a more comprehensive suite of options. You get people around a table, they may have no background in circularity or environment, but a lot of it is common sense. It's about giving people the confidence to think through the opportunities themselves. They don't need complicated rating tools necessarily, although sometimes they can help. It's about thinking through their product, their market, their supply chain in a qualitative way and saying, where is the value in our product? Where is it being lost? Is it in the manufacturing process? Is the consumer throwing it away after 6 months? What else can we do? I think there's probably plenty of people in the room that do similar work with companies. It's not that complicated, but they need a way to start to think it through as a design process, both from a business design as well as a product design or service design.
Anya?
With working on infrastructure projects, they obviously are very impactful in the wrong way for the environment. So we actually start off with our workshops around asking different questions. And the one I always love is going, so what are the waste streams that you've already designed? So what are the things when you come to do your schedule that's going to go to the contracted price? What are the things that are going to landfill, to waste? And how do we stop that? How do we change that? We use the R ladder to go, how do we refuse that? Some of the things we saw in the Netherlands was fascinating. One of the things that the lady actually pointed out as she was talking, that I didn't need to carry on twitching. I could calm down. She would give me all the answers. But she had bridges as a service. So they design a bridge for 100 years, but they know it will move 3, 4, 5 times in its lifetime. So, and especially for us, our performance requirements of our infrastructure keep going up and up and up. So rather than basically pulling the bridge down and sending it to landfill, how about we just move it to where it can still carry out its function just at that level of performance? They have buildings that you can literally dial up and say, can I have an office space for 20, 30 people? And you can use it. They assure me that it's not a container. You know, it's not a, it's good quality. And then you can use it. And then when you're finished with it, you can send it back. So if we think differently, we can actually come up with some really good ideas. Our challenge is when we look at procurement, we often specify standards where actually we need to specify the performance and the outcome that we're after and let innovation come from the industry around some of the different thinking. And then you'll have to have a grown-up conversation around where does the risk sit with it. But I think if we're starting to use the R strategy again, how do we refuse building whatever it is? How do we do a different approach and give them some ideas of to get creative, which is where you get the use in the room because, oh my God, I've been made to feel really uncomfortable quite a few times where they ask me questions and I don't know the answers. But we can work it out together.
That's great. Thanks very much. We're coming to the end of our panel discussion. And I'm reminded, Tania, of what you said about thinking in the past, but also thinking forward. And I tried to find out who actually said this quote, and I wasn't really successful. And this is a quote that's often used. We do not inherit the earth from our ancestors. We borrow it from our children. So with this in mind, I'd like to ask each of our panelists to tell us what they think they need our audience to think about when our audience goes back to work tomorrow morning. So when they go back to their desks tomorrow, whether that's at home or at work, what is the one thing that you would like them to remember and to do at their desks tomorrow? Who wants to go first? Akanya.
Mine, I am actually going to nick it from the session yesterday from Yanis around going, you know, we try and do the best for our kids. And then we go to work and then we just carry on as normal. I am going to personally take that on. I get the pressure from my kids on a regular basis about doing stuff differently. But actually, that's what I would like you all to do. If you are doing things for your kids in the future, and it's not about how much money that bag that you can give them when the rest of the world is burning, what is it that you can do in your day jobs to influence the fact that they will have a form of food security, housing security, and an environment that they can actually thrive in? That would be my thing.
Great. So you're getting them to become a change maker. So all of you, that's your challenge. Become a change maker tomorrow, if not today. Helen?
Well, I don't know, really. I mean, there's been so many ideas floating around today. My head is exploding, really, with so many ideas. And I guess I would just encourage everybody to take one idea that they've learned from today or a connection they've made and actually make it happen, make something happen tomorrow, put something in train, organize a meeting, work out who they need to talk to internally or externally. What's one great new idea that they want to progress, as ambitious as it might be or as difficult as it might be? I mean, I've got a list of about 10 and I've only been here today. So I think I've got lots of ideas and I've already made new connections. So I think it's just about putting it into action, making something, doing something different tomorrow.
Great. So from ideas to action, but keep the ideas coming. Great. Yanis?
I think that's a beautiful quote. And I think just keeping it in mind, because I'm trying to think like in my day to day, how often do I reflect on how this will impact my kids? Not very often at all. Too caught up in the next month, the next week, next meeting. So just being mindful of that, I think will go a long way because it rarely enters my mind during my work hours, to be honest. So thanks for planting that quote. I'll try to be more mindful about it.
Okay, that's great. So be more mindful of what you do. And I'd like to add mine, and especially what I took away from the COP was the urgency. I mean, you know, I can't emphasize it enough. We just don't have time to waste. And we've heard that mentioned before, but also the need to act. Unless and until we do, we're not going to know whether what we did was right or wrong. So we have to look a little bit in the rearview mirror, but we also need to keep our eyes ahead and move forward. And the third most important thing is collaboration. All too often, we start off with things and we start from ground zero. And we don't pick up from what other people have done, or we don't pick up on the mistakes that other people have done or learn from what they have done. And often we want to reinvent the wheel. So success is not just about getting to the end point. It's also about learning and taking that journey to that end point and taking other people with you. So collaborate as much as you can. So with that, any final thoughts or words from our panel? Yes, Yanis.
Like a signed copy of your book, please.
I'm not going to give you a printed copy. I'll give you a soft copy and you can get it for free.
Can I please ask you to not start with recycling? Start at the top and work out how you refuse and rethink. That would be fantastic.
Great. Any other final gone? Thank you to the panelists, Jonas, Helen, and Tanya. Always to you, Maria.
Thank you for